Edward Beauclerc Maurice never knew his father, a suicide on the eve of the First World War. Young Beau grew up in the repressive household of his Victorian grandmother. And then, salvation arrived at his boarding school in the form of a visit from one of the gentlemen adventurers of the Hudson's Bay Company. Beau signed up and kept a remarkable diary over the next 5 years. That diary is now a book, thanks to the efforts of Lawrence Millman, who also wrote the foreword. But how did Edward Beauclerc Maurice decide to become the last gentleman adventurer at the age of 16? What was going through his head?
We all have certain times when we make decisions, almost reactive decisions. I have a feeling, I've read some of his early correspondence, that inside this meek, mild-mannered English lad, there was an adventurer trying to burrow out.
Well, tell me about the land when Edward Beauclerc Maurice got there. What was it like when he arrived?
Well, it wasn't as if he had come to some primitive, uncontacted area where the natives were all living in the way that God or the absence thereof had made them. Quite the contrary. He arrived in Pangnirtung in 1930, and the whalers, followed by traders, followed by missionaries, had been in that part of Arctic Canada for probably around 100 years. So these people were not uncontacted. They knew something of the ways of the white man. They were on the cusp of change. You could say that they were still quite traditional, but modernism was creeping in, and the Hudson Bay Company was one of the sources of that because some of the trade goods were modern trade goods. So he encountered a people in the midst of change, but still, let's say, on the traditional side of the equation. Hmm. People for whom hunting and trapping were the major source of their life's activities.
In this area of Baffin Island, the Eskimos had been in contact with English and American sailors for 70 or 80 years. Cumberland Gulf had attracted the early whalers as a suitable base from which to hunt, and there is no doubt that the impact of these hardy men with their new equipment for hunting was very considerable indeed. Previously, the people had been stuck in a more or less Stone Age period of development, caused not by lack of enterprise, but rather by the harsh nature of their existence. With such implements as they had, they developed an art in hunting and a patience in enduring, without which they could not have survived. To these men with such rudimentary possessions, the first whaling ships must have appeared as veritable Aladdin's caves of undreamed-of treasure. The knives of steel, the guns that thundered death so fast that the eye could not follow, the little sticks that gave flame. There was no end to the wonders of these ships, for nearly everything they used was new to the Eskimo people. Very gradually, life became a mixture of the Stone Age and the modern. The new equipment cost money, more than most people had from work or trade. First of all, the lance and bow gave way to the rifle, but the whalers had nothing to improve upon the lamps that the Eskimos had always used, nor did the homes of skin or snow give way to wood or canvas for many decades. The Eskimos depended entirely upon being able to kill the wildlife of the country for food. By far the most important single item was seal meat, raw, boiled or frozen, fresh, high or putrid. It mattered not. Every particle of the seal except the bones was utilized. The skin for clothing or tent making, the fat for heating or cooking, and the meat for food. According to the season or place, other food was sometimes available. Fish from the river, sea, and lakes, ducks and geese, walrus and polar bears, though the danger of hunting either of these powerful antagonists without a rifle were considerable. And from the stories of the old days, it was certain that few hunters of any account did not have some scar from an encounter with a polar bear.
You talk about Beau as being willing to open himself to his surroundings. He also surprised his employer by learning the Inuit language, didn't he? Did they support his willingness to accept the community into which he was moving?
Well, yes. I think that most traders were obliged to learn some of the language, but they weren't encouraged to learn a whole lot of it because it was thought that if they learned a lot of it, they'd become pals with the locals, and then if somebody brings in some bad fox pelts or doesn't bring in any at all, being pals with the locals, they would be inclined to overlook it. So they were more or less told to keep their lives separate from the lives of locals.
But he was interested in their lives and wanted to know more about them. And he did get, he got very interested in the ways in which the two cultures fit together. Now, the Hudson Bay Company, of course, was primarily interested in trade, specifically in fur. And hunting was central to the culture of the Inuit. Was it a problem ever, or was this simply fortuitous that the two needs went together so well?
It's hard to say. There would have been no other options. The nature of life in the Arctic, especially in the early 1930s, would have been such that to survive, even with a certain degree of furs. I mean, they didn't yet have tinned foods available in the Hudson Bay Company stores. Most of the food type items were flour, or tea, sugar, especially sugar. So to survive, everyone had to hunt.
What did they hunt then? What animals were fair game?
Well, the fox was trapped, but it wasn't eaten. But every other animal, both terrestrial and aquatic, starting with the Arctic hare. And there are some lovely passages in this book where some women sing at the Arctic hares and cause them not to run off. And the singing just seems to entrance them.
We trudged silently up the hillside. Just as we were beginning to think that we had picked a bad afternoon for Okalilks, our leaders stopped us very firmly a short distance below the hill. They beckoned us to take up position, then stood up and began singing a strange chant while moving away from each other on either side of a dip in the slope just ahead of us. In the middle of the dip sat two hares, quite transfixed by the singing, presenting us with a simple stationary target. I had a most instructive afternoon. One of the women told me that the Eskimos had been hunting hares in this way for generations. Sometimes, with a particularly persuasive singer, it is possible to go right up to the animal while it remains motionless. This did not happen with us, but one more hare succumbed to the charm of the women's voices, so we could all look forward to a meal of hare stew.
Now, as the company's representative in these places, and as his experience grew, he was there for several years.
Yes.
Beauclerk Maurice would have been called on to handle medical emergencies as well, right?
Yes.
And when he went, he knew some basic first aid. Did he ever have any training beyond that?
No. His training was in the field, so to speak. In two instances in this book, part of the success is to somehow keep the shaman at bay, to keep the shaman from screaming chants at a patient all night, thus keeping that patient awake, or keeping the shaman from making pronouncements about this is tabooed and that's tabooed and you'll get better if you get rid of these people. That was part of it. And part of it, I just think, was ministering to individuals and just, he really cared for these people. I won't say that that's unusual among white people in the Arctic of that time or any time, but it's unusual to note it in books as he's done here. You know, he fell in love with a whole culture. That's what makes this a remarkable book. This is not your typical chest-thumping macho adventure. You know, we must get to the pole or we won't be men, or we must make the Northwest Passage or die in the process. This is not that kind of adventure at all. It's a more considered, more literary, if you will, account of what it's like to be in the Arctic and to be especially among a people who are still relatively traditional and whom he regards. And I think it's relatively rare for the time. The Inuit were often referred to, even in the 30s, as savages, but the most common prejudicial word was huskies. He didn't see them in that way. But so it's not a book of ethnography by any means, but I think it's the kind of book that is very unusual in the Arctic in that it doesn't have this sort of chest-beating, macho manner that so many other accounts of visits to the Arctic or expeditions to the Arctic or even stays in the Arctic seem to have.
Lawrence Millman wrote the foreword to The Last Gentleman Adventurer, Coming of Age in the Arctic. Thanks to actor Ryan Winkles for reading the diary excerpts from Edward Beauclerk Maurice.